Welcome to the Bulwark Daily. I am your host, Tim Miller. Delighted to welcome back to the show President and CEO of the Center for American Progress. She was domestic policy advisor to Biden. She also served in both the Obama and Clinton administrations. She's in her pearls, which I appreciate. And I've not yet seen her post on X.com so far, which is, a little different from how you seem to be spending your days lately. It's near a tandem.
Nice to be with you.
So good to be with you.
I think.
Welcome back. Oh, yeah. It's always going to be. It's going to be
great.
Fun.
Sounds great.
You're getting sued by the White House and you are tweeting a lot. So we're going to get to both of those things. So you might be getting sued. They're threatening to sue you. We're going to get to those. But first, we had some news last night in South Carolina. Darlene Graham, Lindsey's sister, who apparently knows nothing and doesn't read the news, was nominated by the Republican Party to be the senator from that state for a 6-year term. It's pretty crazy. And she beat Ralph Norman. It was relatively close. Norman had been like one of the key instigators of the insurrection. So not exactly a moderate. But then he did endorse Nikki Haley. And that got Trump's ire. Trump spent a bunch of money in that race. In some ways, I find Darlene Graham to be the kind of the perfect MAGA senator. But what was your reaction to the result last night?
Did you find her to be the perfect MAGA senator? Because she seemed to be almost proud of not knowing anything about foreign policy or like what the job of senator would be.
Well, because she's an empty vessel for Trump. I just think they should make her Senate Majority Leader. Like, John Thune is not representative of the caucus. Okay, John Thune likes to pretend like he has views on things. You know, occasionally he like pretends like he wants to distance himself from Trump, but he never actually does it. Like, Darlene Graham will just do whatever Mr. Trump says. That's what Trump wants in a senator. That's what MAGA voters want in a senator. And so I just think that she should lead a total know-nothing Trump sycophant should be the Senate Majority Leader, I would think, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably more reflective of where the caucus is. I mean, honestly, she's the natural extension of every single vote they've taken, every way that they're lockstep with so much of the cuckoo crazy. That's the natural flow here. I don't think it's easy to win in South Carolina for a Democrat, but I think, you know, hopefully this gives a little bit more oomph to Annie Andrews, who's challenging her.
Yeah, I was intrigued. Laksha Jain, who is, you know, not like a kind of lib hype data analyst. He does some stuff over with our Friends of the Argument. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he pointed out that Lindsey Graham actually underperformed the median Republican often in South Carolina because he sort of was in the sour spot where some MAGA people didn't think that he was MAGA enough because of immigration. And then some moderates thought he sucked up to Trump too much, right? And so he'd usually kind of underperform a little bit. And he was saying that if Darlene performed like Lindsey did and the wave for Democrats was about what they predicted to be right now, that Annie Andrews would only lose by 3. I don't know that the Democrats should be like really investing huge amounts of money in a hopeless South Carolina race, but that's, I thought that it was interesting. Nancy LaCour is kind of a moderate
great candidate.
Veteran. Yeah, she's running in Nancy Mace's old district. I think this could really help her because you can just imagine. Trump was booed at Ralph Norman's concession speech last night.
Yeah, I saw
and
that.
You can imagine people like not being excited to vote for Darlene. It could tamp down turnout and really, I think, help Nancy LaCour in that first district. And who knows? I don't know. Maybe Annie Andrews. What do you think?
I mean, this goes to a broader issue, which we might get into later, which is that what's actually happening in America today, which is, it's really hard for people to see this, but there are people who voted for Trump 3 times. They voted for him in 2016, in 2020, in 2024, you know, like working class people, particularly working class women who are like getting off the Trump train. And I think you see that in some group of Republicans voting for Tallarico in Texas. And I think Darlene Graham puts a lot of pressure on those Republicans who are not so jazzed up about Donald Trump these days. And they could not vote at all, which would be a big problem for the Republicans. I mean, hopefully they would consider voting for Annie Andrews. But I think there's a real opportunity around the country here. And I think the challenge for Trump is that he obviously had to get Graham over the finish line. But she also, I think, pressures a lot of non-MAGA Republicans. And that's like a really important distinction, that there are MAGA Republicans who are kind of lockstep, and they're still the majority of the Republican Party. But there's a sliver of people your old compatriots, per se, who are not MAGA Republicans, who raise questions about Trump and who actually can vote for a rational Democrat.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I do think there'll be turnout issues for Republicans in some of these places. And then, like you said, I think depending on the types of candidates, we will get into this in a minute. But Nancy LaCour is like that type of candidate. She is not a lefty ideologue. You can't like, you know, stereotype her as some kind of like woke socialist or whatever. She's like a military leader. Yeah, right. Moderate, good candidate. That's good for that district. Matches the district. Would be a great upgrade from Nancy Mace. It'd be a nice Nancy upgrade from Nancy to Nancy. And like that is a seat that I'd been flagging for a while that I just think that people are now coming around to the fact that, okay, well, you know, well, maybe not the South Carolina Senate race, we'll see how bad things get for Trump. But like some of these seats that are Trump 10, 11, 12, you know, that Nancy Mace didn't even have an election, really. I mean, like Nancy Mace's election wasn't that competitive in 2024, and now that seat could be gone.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think this is what's interesting about the map expanding over the last, really in August, you've seen more and more races come on sort of the board. Adam Hamilton, yep, running in Kansas, great candidate, is running very, very competitive race. I have no idea what to learn from polls, but at this point, sure. But independent polls have shown that it's a close race. And, you know, I think there is a kind of, given all these elections in the past, there are a lot of Democrats who are like, I'm not getting my hopes up about Republican crossover after all of these elections with Trump, but we are seeing some real evidence of it. And I will say, it's not just polls. You are seeing in special elections, Democrats winning districts that have been plus 10, plus 15, plus 16 Republican districts. Trump won by that much in this race just in Pennsylvania the last week, which was a general, ended up being a special election. So there are a lot of people who are crossing over, or just a big problem for them is a lot of Republicans are staying home. And I mean, I think a central issue here is not to put up candidates that Republicans are compelled to come out and vote against.
I'm going to have some more map talk at the end, but I want to talk about your lawsuit. So essentially what's happening is Trump's personal lawyer threatened a $5 billion defamation lawsuit against the Center for American Progress. Interesting. It was not over something that you said, which is surprising. I would have lost that bet. I would have thought if Cap got sued by the Trump administration, it would have been a near, you know, issue, but statement. It wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't. In this case. You guys at Cap put out a report about the National Guard, concluded that these deployments had little effect on violent crime rates. It cost taxpayers $1.7 billion, and that hurt Trump's feelings, and so he's suing you. What is that? Is that the gist?
Yeah, that's pretty much the gist. Essentially, he saw the author of the report, Chandler Hall, who did a great job with this report. Trump saw him on C-SPAN. I didn't realize he had time for C-SPAN viewing.
Really? That's really what happened?
It's like, you look at his social media post, his tweet social post on this from 2 weeks ago, and it really does seem like he watched Chandler Hall on C-SPAN. Because the report came out like a month and a half ago, and Chandler was on C-SPAN, and Trump is reacting to C-SPAN, and he didn't like the report.
So either the human printer showed him the C-SPAN clip.
Yes.
Or maybe he got mad at Fox one day and at the club at Mar-a-Lago, he's sitting there eating his well-done hamburger before the golf course or after. And he told them to put on C-SPAN instead. Those are the only two theories I have.
Yes. I mean, it's weird. I don't really think of him as watching like Washington Journal every morning, but but he somehow saw this Chandler talk about the report. And I do want to say, you know, he attacked us early that week. That Friday, August 14th, he was planning, you know, he did a big campaign in Nassau County in New York, basically attacking Democrats on crime, talking about the National Guard deployment. So I do think he thinks this report is a problem for him, and that's why he's attacking us. Now, the report goes through three models. It analyzes violent crime, gun crime, homicide rates. the rate of violent crime reduction in the cities with deployments versus without cities that didn't have deployments. It's really a factual analysis of how, despite spending, you know, as much as $1.7 billion on this, on National Guard deployments, we don't have evidence that they are actually reducing crime. And, you know, there's a Reuters story just recently about how in D.C., National Guard have been involved in less 1% or less than 1% of actual, you know, arrests. So NPR has a story out that, you know, was talking to National Guard in D.C. saying that they don't think they're doing anything. And it's basically a political ploy. So, you know, I mean, I don't think he likes the fact that we are calling out that this is, could be, a, you know, real waste of a lot of money. So,
yeah, and these people's lives, you know, like they have lives in their home states, you know, it's back to school time, right? It's like, you know, some they have other jobs, you know, who is parenting, right? Like there are a lot of like real human considerations for these guys just to walk. And I was in D.C., I was blown away when I was in D.C. recently. It's like they're circling DuPont Circle. It's kind of walking around the park. They're like these guys in like a military Humvee outside of LaDroite Park. I'm just like, what is the point of this?
Exactly.
Like, this is just theater.
That is an issue we raised. And we basically asked the question, which is, if it's not actually having an impact on crime rates, then why is he spending this money? And just, you know, it's $1.7 billion, a lot of money. And you could actually feed people with that or give them healthcare or not take away so many people's healthcare. You know, that's like real money.
Feeding people and giving healthcare is important. It also really salts the vibes in the French Quarter. I think they're finally leaving the French Quarter, but it's like, we don't need dudes in military gear, like walking around Bourbon Street. You know, we're trying to enjoy ourselves here.
Yeah. I can't say it's so great for tourism to have National Guard troops deployed in your, next to your
not necessary.
Like, local favorite tavern.
Yeah. You know, I just want to have my purple Drake Lafitte. Yeah. I don't need a guy in a military fatigues and a gun looking at me while I'm trying to have a purple drink. We joke about it, but I do just want to sit for 1 second on like everything with Trump. It's like there's part of it that's idiocracy and farce, and there's part of it that's really malicious that came in allegedly, you know, talking about free speech, and they had these, you know, this fake outrage over Biden, you know, ways in which the Biden administration was concerned about misinformation on social media. And they thought that was a infringement on free speech. And now they come in and time and again, they're trying to bully media outlets, activists, like people exercising their free speech rights. And it's not precedented, you know, and I do feel like there should be more outrage about it.
Just to say what this really is in my mind is, first of all, it's an escalation from like attacking media outlets to a research institution. Of course, I will say we're ideological, you know, we're progressive, we're center left. But the report itself is all based on data and analysis. And it's really the cornerstone of what research institutions are. I mean, we are looking at a federal government policy and analyzing its impact. If that's subject to a $5 billion defamation suit, or if that's not basically protected speech, it's really hard to know what would be. I mean, and what is also kind of extraordinary about this is we have a criticism of a Trump administration policy, and his personal lawyer is arguing that it's defamation against him, which is like kind of insane to think that saying his policies don't work is defamation against the president. If that's allowed to stand, it's hard to know what could be offered in like the public discourse on federal policy. It would be hard to imagine anything that isn't basically the narrative of the Trump administration surviving critique. So obviously it's kind of a cuckoo situation, but I do think there's a very serious issue here, which is really trying to bully organizations and get them to self-censor. I think this is a whole part of what they do, which is obviously we are going to stand up and we believe that this is a bullying tactic, and the Center for American Progress 100% stands by the report and will kind of, you know, fight tooth and nail against this bullying tactic. But other organizations, you know, will think twice about what they say about the president and worry about this. And that is part of
their
goal.
Is this worth the hassle?
Yeah, is it worth the hassle? Should we just not, you know, maybe we shouldn't mention their name or talk about a government policy and not have it really be about Trump? And that is like what their goal is. And as I said to my team, you know, I think one of the tactics of this administration is to use fear to get people to self-censor. And we are not going to do that. So, and I think it's also important for us to role model, like, not giving into bullies. And so it's unpleasant. I will say it's not a pleasant thing to deal with, but I think it's
important. You got to meet with all the lawyers. Okay, yeah. You go through this, you know, when there's various threats, and it's like, it's coming from the personal lawyer of the president. It's expensive. Not every think tank is that well capitalized, right?
And we're going to end up paying. I mean, we're paying money for this. I mean, we have insurance and other things, but insurance doesn't cover everything. So CAP is putting out resources because of this attack. So, but like the choice between standing up and paying something versus, you know, taking our report down is like not a close call for us.
Yeah, you picked the wrong person on the playground to try to bully on this one. I feel like it was a mistake strategically, but I appreciate that you guys are fighting it. Speaking of their propaganda efforts, I thought this just before, you know, we got into kind of Democratic, you know, back and forth within the Democratic Party, we might have a little palate cleanser before we start that section of the podcast. Because there is some crazy propaganda that's happening out there from somebody that you've had some back and forth with on CNN, and that is Scott Jennings. He's currently auditioning to be the press secretary for some reason, which is interesting. I was skeptical of this at first because it's like he could make a lot more money on the outside and, you know, it's less busy and whatever. But he seems to really want to be the press secretary based on credible reporting. And here he was in his radio.
Because when you're a press secretary, you're on TV a lot. You're probably on TV even more.
I did like the back and forth between him and Caitlin, where he's like, Caitlin, you wouldn't be excited to get to work with me every day? And Caitlin's like, Scott, I see you all the time. And he's like, you'd get to see me more. Caitlin was like, I think I see plenty. But anyway, here he was in his radio show. New goatee, new GLP-1. Like the shirt is a little baggy. And he's talking about the situation in Iran. I want to play that for you.
And I believe this announcement may confirm something that many in our political class refuse to acknowledge. The United States has won the war against Iran. Wars are won when one side achieves its strategic objectives and the other loses the ability to achieve its own.
With the American flag and everything, like this could be a spoof movie. Like if you saw this in a spoof movie, you'd be like, okay, sure. But like that is real. Like he's doing North Korea propaganda behind a fake American flag backdrop, talking about how we won in Iran. What?
Yeah, I have to say, I have had the great
displeasure.
Displeasure to be on a Newsnight, Abby Phillips show with Scott. And, you know, I think the thing that drives Scott Jennings is defending Donald Trump at all costs. He will pervert any fact, create any fiction, draw any insane picture to rationalize, justify, excuse the president of the United States, which makes him actually a perfect candidate for press secretary. To me, Scott Jennings has been like auditioning to be the next press secretary for the last year and a half. And as someone who's definitely sparred with Scott Jennings, like the first time I did Abby Phillips, I happened to criticize him about his wild outrage and anger about the Tesla protests while kind of excusing the January 6th thing. And I swear to God, he was going to call me a bitch on TV, but held himself back. It was really angry. And so since then, we haven't been particularly close in the green room or anything. But my take on him is, you know, he is out for fame, book sales. He loves traveling around the country, makes him really happy to talk to the White House on the phone. And so he'll be excited. You know, I'm not surprised at all that he's being seriously considered.
Have a little dignity, though. Honestly. And everybody, you've had to spin, Neera. Everyone's had to spin. We've all been in the game before. Not me anymore. I get to do Radical Candor. I'm a podcaster. But, I used to be a flack. You have to spin. To go on and be like, we have won the war in Iran. I mean, it's Baghdad Bob style.
I've been on the show with him for months now. I mean, I'm not on as much as he is, but I've been on since the Iran war. Every week I am on saying, look what's happening. We are losing the war. And he will say, no, we are winning the war. So it is obviously an added dramatic effect to have the full North Korea flag waving back. But it's not different than what he's been saying for months. And, you know, I mean, what is interesting is, to be serious, we are coming up. August 28th will be the 6-month anniversary of this war. Wow. Where people like Scott Jennings and everyone else has been saying we are winning this war, and we are obviously not winning this war. So they have been lying to the American people for months about a war. And I think that's reprehensible, but not unexpected from Scott Jennings.
I watched an old clip of him from May or March. I don't know, where he's talking about, oh, come on, that this is going to be over soon. Give us a little bit more time. And like, here we are coming up on Labor Day. This is an unconfirmed report. I don't usually like to share these, but I think it's interesting because, you know, there's stuff being bandied around about this. The CIA director, Ratcliffe, went to Moscow. My guy, Michael Weiss and Mark Polymeropoulos, if you guys have missed this, they're doing a series for us now on YouTube. So people can check that out. And they kind of batted around the various reasons why Ratcliffe could have gone there. But one report we have is that he was essentially asking Moscow to press Iran into reopening the Strait of Hormuz because of, you know, the issues to the oil market, and basically threatening Russia and saying, hey, we're going to put the sanctions back on that Trump took off because he liked you. And like, you might think he liked you, but we're going to put the sanctions back on if you don't pressure Iran on the Strait of Hormuz. And Russia said no. So I don't like, regardless of like, if that is true, you know, like humiliating if true, I guess. But like the fact that we are here and that it could be right, like that, like I think one boat went through the Strait of Hormuz on Monday. I haven't seen the Tuesday's numbers, but like that's where we're at 6 months in.
Yeah. I mean, with or without this Russia story, you know, let's just step back and say, the Iranians are dictating terms on the Strait of Hormuz today. They are dictating terms to Donald Trump on how to cease hostilities. If you had said to me a year ago or 8 months ago that somehow Donald Trump would manage to strengthen Iran, the Iranian regime, I would have said that's really hard to imagine. But here we are, and the United States is in a war in Iran. Just as a reminder, Donald Trump decided to do this war on his own, and we are all paying for it. We're paying more for gas. We're paying more for a whole range of things. Things are pretty expensive. And he is at the point where he is sort of begging other countries to ally with us against Iran, to put pressure on Iran. And you know what's happening? Our European allies were like, hey, you're on your own. Other countries are like, hey, you're on your own. Because this guy told them to kind of screw off over the last year and a half. So you look around the world, and I mean, it sounds insane, but somehow Iran is a more sympathetic actor around the country, around the world. That's insane. They're a terrible regime, horrible regime. But he's screwed this up so badly that we don't have an open Strait of Hormuz. Gas prices are pretty high, and he can't make a deal. This is my analysis. I said this before, but the real reason why he can't make a deal, because it will be clear that he's lost as soon as he makes that deal. Like, we are losing this war. It's just a question of the finality of that, how clear the loss will be. And, you know, contra Scott Jennings, if you are in a situation where the Iranians have control of the Strait of Hormuz, then we are losing this war.
Deep breath. Now we get to the section I've titled Bones to Pick with Neera. Okay, here we go. Look, one reason why we love each other is because we're both posters at heart. You know, we both just want to express our views. And I was your number one defender when those just cowardly Republican senators were like, Neera was mean to me on Twitter. I can't confirm her. We're mad at Neera.
Doesn't it seem funny now? Yeah. Like, given everything that's ever, like, everywhere that Trump has said about everybody.
Yep, this happened. This was something that happened. Republican senators were whining about Neera's, the Neera was too mean to them on Twitter.
I did say that Susan Collins was the worst, and I stand by that.
And I think vindicated by time. So that was 6 years ago. Your Twitter energy, though, lately has been a little bit off of Susan Collins, for my taste. Mm-hmm. I counted this morning 15 tweets about Hassan Piker since Sunday. You and Ryan Grimm seem like Peter Twinkwich posted this, that I do think it's kind of charming that Ryan Grimm and Neera Tanden don't block each other and keep lashing at each other's throats every day. You rarely see that manner of A-grade Wagyu beef anymore.
I don't really. I think I'm not the one tweeting at Ryan most of the time.
I would say the same thing to Ryan if he was on. I'm sorry. No imbalance. A lot of attacking the left right now from you on the Twitter account when we have a big challenge ahead of us in November. And so talk to me about that.
Yes, I think this is a really important thing to discuss. So I actually appreciate the opportunity to talk about this because I want to make a distinction. And I've said this publicly. I said this to the New York Times like a month or two ago, which is where DSA candidates win in blue cities. Like, that's a healthy thing for a party. It's okay for a Democratic broad tent to have very liberal candidates in very liberal parts of the country. And when people complain about this, I say to them, there are like some really cuckoo members in like MAGA parts of the country. And, you know, like, it's a big tent and we should be growing that. My concern, and it's a genuine concern, is that Hassan Piker is noxious to the brand of the Democratic Party in swing states and swing districts. And I'm always for a big tent, but big tents have tent poles. And tent pole for me is we should be against racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. You and I have talked in the past about past Senate races and how some of them have implicated some of those issues. And I try to be consistent and say, I don't think it's great to do those things at a moral level. And then to be honest about it, I also think it's a terrible political strategy. Now, I know a lot of Democrats were like, Trump is so terrible. Why can't we be as terrible? Like, we need our own people.
That's not my position.
No, I know it's not your position.
I'm talking about strategy.
Yeah.
I'm talking about strategy. Like, Abdul won.
Yes.
15 tweets about Piker this week feels like a lot. Like, Abdul won.
Yeah,
I've got things that I could nitpick Abdul about, but like, he's not campaigning with the Sun anymore. Like, that was in the past.
Exactly.
And again, why keep talking about it? It's like not that helpful.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I feel like I have tried to be clear that it's good. It's a good thing that he's moved off of Piker. And I've said multiple times I would support Abdul Al-Sayed. I think this is a good step. A lot of people looked at his statement and said, oh, it's not enough. Abdul Al-Sayed's statement, it's not enough. I think this is a good step. You know, you can't, like, it's good when people do stuff you want them to do. That's great. But I'll tweet less if you'd like.
No, I like your tweeting. I'm trying to get like an 80-20.
Yeah, no,
I also want to hear your real thoughts, right? Like, look, I've said this before too. Like, this is all, there's balance in all things. You know, I think at some level, you don't have to comment on this since you were in the White House. Like, we could have used a few more people talking about how we had concerns about Biden's electability going ahead to 2024. Like, sometimes when you circle the wagons too much, you actually do self-harm, right? And so I agree with that, like flagging issues within the coalition, flagging things that people are doing that are hurting the chances of victory. Like, I'm for all that. What I'm not for is just like fight to the death between like the factions and the party and having that be the main focus. And like, I am seeing a little bit of that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I guess what I'd say is, like, you know, I do back and forth in this. I'll just be really honest. You know,
sure.
You know, why do I need to talk about any of this? I just get yelled at a lot. You can see I get yelled at a lot. But I do have people come up to me and say, who are scared of, like, maybe an online mob or something, and say, it's really important that your voice is out there standing up for things like it's wrong to have any anti-Semitism or any Islamophobia or any of these issues. And so, you know, I think part of the challenge is that now there'll be a counter narrative saying anyone who criticizes them is they're fighting Hassan Piker more than Republicans, which is like, I really think genuinely we should all focus on defeating Mike Rogers. And I thought it was a good step that Abdul al-Sayed took, the step he took, and it's a good thing to focus on.
And this is an area where I will also come to your defense. People complain about this. I was like, Nir has been in the fucking trenches fighting this guy for 10 years. A lot of people who had Nir's job in the Obama White House or equivalent moved to Seattle or San Francisco, did very well for themselves in the private sector and while the country burned. So I have nothing but love for you on that. One other just strategic point that I do want to
raise. Yeah, this is a fair debate.
I just think that, like, look, sometimes I feel like both sides have little blinders on this, both sides within the Democratic faction, which is like, this is a Matt Iglesias point about Syed that I totally agree with. It is like really important right now for Abdul to be focused on reaching out to Alyssa Slotkin voters who are moderate, people that voted for Alyssa Slotkin when she won in 2024, when Kamala lost, and saying to them, hey, I am closer to your interests, goals, needs, desires than Mike Rogers for this reason, right? Like, that's important for him to do.
100%.
100%. So I know we agree with that.
And it's important for the moderates to
exactly. And this is where I come in. Like, and this is my issue about Piker. And like, the Piker thing is kind of a stand-in for this point. If you know, people have personal issues with him, I get it. Like, he said some things that I obviously find, you know, wrong. But I think that moderates need to signal to the Bernie Trump voters, who are going to be also important swing voters in this cycle. You mentioned at the beginning, like, hey, I hear you about the wars, by the way. You know what? Like, maybe we are a little bit, you know, maybe we went along a little bit too much with these kind of wars that both parties supported. I hear you about corporate influence. You know, and like, I think we need to be more aggressive in fighting corporate influence in our elections. And so sometimes I feel like I see more energy from the moderate faction talking about why the lefties are bad than I do see them saying, hey, I disagree with you on some things, but I hear you on these other things. And I'm actually going to fight for that.
Yeah. Too. So I'll go even further than this is what you're saying. Okay.
Great.
I think where the left is really right is that things are really bad in the country. So I think where, you know, you have moderates kind of talking about incrementalism and the left talking about more radical change, I think that's going to actually push people towards the left because, you know, they are, the left is right that it's insane that we do have a trillionaire dictating election outcomes by the level of spending he's doing. And like, that is oligarchy. And they are right. I mean, the fundamental analysis that things are really broken in the country is actually very right. And I actually think center-left people or, you know, kind of normies, you know, it's our job to compete on ideas. That's why I don't think it makes sense to launch a campaign against DSA or things. I think, like, the thing is, like, if you think DSA is wrong, offer better ideas. Right. Like, I spend a lot of my time thinking about how it is a big problem that the bottom, you know, 60, 65, maybe 70% of Americans are really stuck. You know, like, we have less upward mobility. Their incomes have not kept up with costs. Like, that is a legitimate and accurate fight. And I do think there are big issues around affordability that actually unite moderates and the middle and left. And the left is really right about a lot of issues. So I'm not, like, fighting off like the left per se. My concern genuinely is how to win. I mean, you know this as well as I do. Post 2030, Democrats have to win in states. The blue wall is not enough. They have to start, you know, they have to win in states like Iowa or Ohio or,
right,
you know, places like that, North Carolina for sure. And so to me, I think the real question in front of us is how do you build a big enough tent? And then how do you ensure that you're doing that in a way where you embrace, like, your base and the left or who the broad tent in the Democratic Party without doing things that alienate, like, kind of Republicans who can come on board or independents? And I think Bernie Sanders is a great example of that.
Yeah, that's my point about both sides. Like, I do think that lefties have some crazy candidates who say things that alienate moderate voters. I also just, this is just anecdotal, but in my social life, I don't think that, because obviously more people that I talk to are more aligned with more moderate or center candidates. And I don't think that they have just internalized how much they have alienated gettable voters, like particularly on, our relationship with Israel and the wars in the Middle East, but also on like corporate capture and stuff like that. And like, it just works both ways, right? Like it just does. Mm-hmm. And I think that like, unfortunately, in Georgia, the coalition is probably big enough to, now because of the way things go, to win with kind of black voters and never Trump or college educated, never Trumpers in the Atlanta suburbs. Like that's a big enough coalition to win Georgia, but to win in these states like Iowa and Ohio, like you got to go back to the Obama, Trump, Bernie voters. And that's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, but I mean, let's be honest about this, okay? I mean, there's like a lot of data behind this. And I think we should be really, really like genuinely honest. And I think
always.
So that group of people, let's not look backwards, let's look forwards. Donald Trump is losing people who voted for him, as we talked about, people who voted for him three times. That group of people that he's losing now, and probably because of this war, tend to be working class white voters, predominantly women. Hey, guys are still hanging on, but the women, there are a lot of women who have questions about Trump. Those voters are economically populist. They don't think the political system works very well. They do think both political parties kind of are corrupt. And they like, I think there are many ways that they are like kind of Sanders friendly. And that's like really, that's important. Listen, they are very moderate on crime and immigration and on some cultural issues as well. Yeah. And so that's why you see a Rob Sand and a Tallarico take some of the positions they have. And my only plea to everyone is to give like grace to candidates running in states like Iowa, Texas, Ohio, Alaska, to take on issues, really more security related issues that are going to be very different, and don't call them sellouts and jerks for doing it.
And now I'm going to outflank you because I think that's right. And I think that right now what I'm seeing from a lot of Democratic candidates is it's easy and comfortable within the coalition to say, hey, we should be more economically populist right now because everybody supports that. Like you said, even moderate supporters, so they don't get in much trouble for saying that, really. Maybe with some donors, but like for the most part, I think they don't get in much trouble for that. And then they like kind of do this kind of vague lip service to like, you know, we also should move to the middle on immigration or crime or like be responsible. You know, we want to keep people safe. But there's nothing like when you ask them about where their policies are different from Harris policies or whoever, there's nothing there. And you know what I mean? And it's like, this is going to require a little bit of like meeting people in the middle on some of those issues, particularly around crime and immigration. And I mean, I'm like John Lennon, open borders on immigration. So this is like in both of these issues, this is an admission against interest. I'm not really that economically populist, even though I am. Painful taxation on the rich, I'm fine for. Now, I've come around on that. Bernie's won me over. I've met too many rich people. But I also like am pretty liberal on immigration, extremely liberal on immigration. But like, you just have to be real.
Yeah, I mean, and I will say, look, Cap has put forward papers and ideas on immigration. And those ideas on immigration would secure the border, reform asylum, which is a key component to securing the border, but also expand legal immigration, give people a path to citizenship. And our whole argument about this is we can tell the country you don't have to have this like terrorizing ICE organization to secure the border.
Right.
And that's like a position that most people have. But you do have to tell people, particularly in these states, how you're going to secure the border. We also put forward a crime plan that is focused on what's reduced crime. Coming back to our topic, what is reduced crime in cities like Baltimore? And that is, prevention, but it's also additional police and detectives, and also, ensuring that you're having swift punishments for lawbreakers. And so, but I also think those are just conversations like working class people are pretty moderate on those issues. And I don't think, and I guess I'd say I would hope that there's a big tent for everybody, for candidates in more conservative leaning states to be able to take those positions. And then candidates in very liberal cities to be able to take their positions.
Oh, you mentioned Rob Sand. I want to talk about him in particular. He was in this town hall. There's this video going viral. Did you see this? Talking about how to treat his opponent, Zach Lane.
Yeah.
This is Rob Sand is doing some things that are totally outside of the conversation at all. And I want to bring this up because, like, the way that he is veering is not on this kind of moderate leftist.
Yeah, this is very important.
Valence at all. You know, he's just like doing things very differently. And so I want to just give two examples of that, that these are not policy issues at all. It's just he's sounding totally different. I want to play one video of him in a town hall talking about his opponent, who's awful.
Politics is oftentimes pretty stupid. I think that we can acknowledge that me and my opponent are human beings and that everyone who runs for office should be willing to do that because it's important. All right. Now, I still think that I'm the better choice, and I'll tell you why. But I'm not going to do it without asking you first to keep in mind that this is a debate between two human beings. We don't need to demonize people, and we don't need to lie about them either.
That is going against the conventional wisdom in Dem circles that is like, we need to go lower. Michelle Obama was wrong. And I don't know. I watched Rob Sand give a speech to a Democratic audience where he was talking a lot about his, you know, dad's Republican friend and how they wait for coffee and how Republicans have good ideas. And like, look, this is a state Trump won by 11 or 12. And he's modeling like how to like really signal to people, like not pay lip service, but like really signal like, no, like you can be comfortable with me if you voted for Trump.
Yeah. I mean, this is a really crucial element of all of this, which is I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact that in order to have a Democratic Senate or to win the House back, you actually have to compete for people who voted for Trump. And how do you do that? I mean, there's issues that are a part of that, but there's also what kind of message you're sending in general. And like, I think people should really study Rob Sand's race because in everything he does, he's trying to communicate that he would be a governor for everybody. Not just one fact, one side, one party. He'd be a governor for everybody. And look, I am a hard fighter. Okay? Like on the fighter fold dynamic, kind of definitely in the fighting. But I also recognize that
we're not running you for Senate in Iowa. Everyone's got a role to play. Okay.
Like, but also, my personal view is I would like this nightmare of Trump to be over. And the only way I can figure out how to make it over is to have people win in kind of Republican leaning states. So Republicans wonder like what they are doing. And maybe that won't happen either, but it's better than just sitting here going in 50-50 elections and like looking at this like general degradation of our country.
Here's something else Rob Sand did yesterday. Jay Martin, our friend Jonathan Martin, interviewed him.
Oh, this is the part I thought you were going to start with.
Yeah, I'm going here. Whatever you think about these answers, he doesn't sound like a politician. Here's Jonathan Martin. Would you want to have Joe Biden here campaign for you? Sand. No. Can he even do that right now? Jay Martin. How about Kamala Harris? No, thanks. Let's move on. We need some new leadership. Jay Martin. You don't think Harris should run in 2028? Sand. No. Jay Mart, who do you think is good for 2028? Then he goes off to say, I'm focused on this race and here are the things that really matter, future, etc. Whatever you think about those answers, those are real answers, not politician answers.
Radical candor.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, to me, I think this is like an important lesson for all of us. Like, are we all going to give grace to Rob Sand to say, like, to say what he needs to say or say what he believes or say, you know, like, I just think that's, I'm going to give him grace to do that. You know, like I think it's like really important that he wins that race. And I think he believes everything he's saying. And I think I do think the way he just says yes or no is really important. You know, like I think people are done with politician speak.
Rob Sand, 48, Zach Lane, 44 in the poll out this morning. Zach is the sex toy magnate that lives in Kansas. And I saw a video of him the other day talking about how he's concerned about the call to prayer in Michigan. So it's a Kansas candidate that's invested in cock rings who's campaigning in Iowa about people praying in Michigan.
Those are your birds?
Do you disagree with any of them? Are any of them wrong?
No, I don't. I don't disagree with any of them, but I'm just saying for
that's pretty crazy. I'm just saying
suing,
a lot of
it's
we
not
spend
me.
A lot of tough we spend a lot of time clutching our pearls over here, me and Nira, talking about things we're concerned that some of the we do have some kooky candidates on our side, but it's like we don't got anything like that.
It's so interesting because like I criticize Republicans all the time, and then people are like, you don't criticize Republicans enough. And I was like, look, not you. You don't do that. But like people say that to me. And I was like, the real problem in the Republican Party is that they go along with, you know, kind of ruining the country. So that's really bad. And they should stop doing that.
Sam Stein has forced me to ask you one last question. Are you ready for it?
Oh, God. I'm not going to answer any Sam Stein question. Okay, well, I just have a policy against it.
And you're right, probably. I'm not going to answer this. What do you think about how Ken Martin is doing?
Do I feel like I'm so good at pre-budding that I'm not going to answer this question.
Okay. Sam's follow-up question to you. Would you consider taking his role if asked? If asked.
No.
Is that a Sherman-esque denial?
100% Sherman-esque denial. And I don't think people who claim to like me should want me to take that job.
That is something that we agree on 100%. Okay,
it's our job.
Anything else you need to get off your chest? Anybody you want to yell about? Anything that Cap is doing that you want people to know about?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I would say you were grateful for all the support against her lawsuit. It is expensive. So go to our website, Center for American Progress at AmericanProgress.org, and check out all the things we're doing. And I will say we have a lot of ideas on how to lower costs for Americans. And I'm really grateful of all the leaders across the country who are using those ideas to govern and also, you know, in some of their races.
The corruption tracker that you're doing is also really useful and something that I turn to a lot. And I actually feel now I'm chastising myself now. Because we should have brought this up before we got to you know Michigan Senate discourse. Because I mean that is related to affordability.
Yeah.
And Democrats got to talk about both. That's what Ossoff's doing, Sands doing, others are doing. The people that are doing really well are doing a really good job, tell Rico, of like tying those two issues together.
Yeah, and I think a really important thing to remember about corruption or the $1.7 billion National Guard deployments is. It's really important for us to remind people these are the choices the president's making. He's like finding $100 billion for the Iran war while he's cutting people's health care. He's spending $1.7 billion on National Guard deployments while he's cutting SNAP payments and like basically food payments for people who are hungry. That is the kind of choices that we're dealing with and why change is so necessary.
We'll leave it there. It's Nira Tandon. We'll see you on X.com and we'll have you back on, I don't know, probably before the midterms. All right.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.
I'll see you then. Everybody else, we'll be back here tomorrow for another edition of the pod. See you all then. Peace. Bulwark Daily is brought to you thanks to the work of lead producer Katie Cooper, associate producer Ansley Skipper, and with video editing by Dante DeChico and audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.